This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You are listening to a Radio EcoShock special assessment of the Cancun Climate Talks held in Mexico in early December 2010. It's your planet, your kids' future. I'm Alex Smith with What You Need to Know. This is Radio EcoShock, and when we need a critical eye on the street, Franklin Lopez is the man. He's a cameraman, he's a producer, he's a super video editor, an anarchist, an activist. He's based in Vancouver, but roaming where the action is. As the stimulator, his free-swinging videos get millions of views. His video podcast is It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. And that says a lot about Franklin, I would say. In December 2010, Frank was at the United Nations Climate Conference in Cancun, Mexico. He was on the streets. Frank, I'll bet you were not there to get sound bites from the usual talking heads. Why did you go to Cancun?
Well, primarily I went to Cancun to screen a film that I just completed called NCIF. And just shortly, it's a film based on the ideas of Derek Jensen, and I felt that the film was really made for environmental activists. And I wanted to have it ready for the COP15, but that was just physically impossible. But the second reason I went there was to report on the grassroots activists that was going to happen around the COP16. So I joined a caravan of buses from Chiapas, from the city of San Cristobal, about 250 of us divided into five buses, 23 hours through the treacherous roads of Mexico. And we finally made it through five military checkpoints and to one of the two activist camps that were set up in Cancun.
Did you get a hard time from people as you were going there? And were these camps hospitable to alternative media?
Both camps were very grassroots. Actually, the folks who organized the bus caravan were organized in a space called Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space. And that was a collaboration between a bunch of different groups, including Otros Mundos, Friends of the Earth, and Oxfam. I ended up not staying at that camp. I went to the Villa Campesina Mexico camp because that's where the anti-capitalist bloc, they were calling themselves anti-cop, were set up. And both camps were, you know, it's an unbelievable way of organizing. And I wish, aside from the content of the actual camps, which we can get into later, that way of organizing really facilitates people taking time off of work to actually do something worthwhile for their world. For example, both camps had giant circus-type tents where people could actually sleep under unless you had your own tent. Both camps provided free food throughout the week. And then, of course, there were speakers and such throughout the both camps. At the Villa Campesina camp, they even had a Wi-Fi internet connection that was amazingly powerful, and I was able to produce media from that actual camp. And, of course, there was electricity. The showers weren't cold, but at least you can take a shower. And just some of the realest people I've ever met within the activist scene.
We see the climate camp model has happened in the UK and Britain, but hardly anywhere in North America that I'm aware of. Do you know of some climate camps that have happened in Canada or the United States?
Yeah, I know that this summer in Montreal, there was a climate camp, although I was not able to make it. But even like within the context of outside of the climate activism, the G20 in Toronto, I mean, that would have been an amazing place to actually have something like that. Although one of the organizing groups there did something that I had never seen done in Canada, and it maybe has to do with my little time in Canada. But they actually provided food during one of the actions, food before the march and food after the march. And that really made it easy and affordable for people to do this. So I think that for organizers in Mexico, that was an amazing way to get people who are essentially poor. I mean, most of the people that came to these camps were rural Mexicans who were there to basically say that the climate is destroying their crops, the climate is affecting their lives. They had some clear demands.
So there is an awareness in Mexico about climate change issues.
Well, that's a tricky question, right? Because when you look at the COP15, the amount of people that actually went to that particular mobilization was, you know, I wasn't there, but just looking at the reports, was way larger, like by a huge long shot than Mexico. I mean, the Cancun mobilization, some estimates say, like, you know, it tops out of 5,000 people. Now, when you consider the dire situation that we're in, these mobilizations really matter. They are some of the most important activist work that we can do, regardless of whether or not you sit on the, you know, anarchist side, which is, you know, wants to reject the talks altogether, or if you're part of the people who want to beg the government for change. I think in a sense, like climate activism, it's a very privileged type of activism. People in the first world can really actually take the time to look at these, at the science, and look at these predictions that are going to happen, even the stuff that's happening right now, and actually do activism around something that may or may not affect them in the present, right? When you look at places like Mexico or Latin America, they have their plate full. They're already dealing with land issues. They're already trying to preserve their culture. There's still many indigenous people who live in Mexico who are day in, day out trying to protect, you know, what's left of their land. So to ask them, you know, they do understand what climate change is what it's doing, but they also have, in a sense, like reality is at their door, and they're fighting, you know, super projects like dams, like highway expansions, forced relocations into what they're calling almost like rural cities is what they're calling in Chiapas, I think, where they're basically trying to get, you know, campesinos, like farmers, to move to these, you know, sort of like planned communities and basically leave the land alone for the government to use for whatever else.
What were some of the actions that you saw there that could inspire us?
Well, like I said, I was there mostly to report on the activities of the anti-capitalist bloc. And they had certainly a small contingent within the larger mobilization there. On their very first action, which they actually held a spokes council the day before to decide what they wanted to do, was to go to an agency called the PROFEPA. And the PROFEPA, it's an acronym that basically, it's the Ministry of the Environment in Mexico. And these are the folks who are supposed to be protecting the environment, but just like in the United States or in other countries, you know, they actually facilitate the building of super projects like dams, et cetera. So the action was to try to go in front of the actual building, the actual government building. And since people felt that the PROFEPA was, part of my French was pooping on them, then they were going to poop on the PROFEPA. So they gathered an enormous amount of excrement, and they had a catapult, and they were actually headed over there. But, you know, the action was pretty well known, and riot police blocked the way. So the only people who got pelted with the poop were the riot police.
Right, to the barricades for sure. Were there any signs of violence, or did things go peacefully?
You know, when you go to protests in North America, you certainly see like large numbers of police, really well armed, usually with less lethal weapons, tear gas, flashbang grenades and whatnot. In Mexico City and Cancun, the police had fully automatic rifles. You saw it everywhere. It was like an occupied city. And even within the face of that potential police violence, people were amazingly fearless in confronting the police. But people understood also that they were outnumbered. Also, people understood that there was an action that was reached consensus on that action, and that people were not going to break consensus. So as much as there were some people who really wanted to have it out with the cops and try to get to the actual building, once it was understood that there was probably one policeman for every protester, the marchers decided to just basically turn back and just have a party.
You say anti-capitalist, so are you saying that these talks really just shouldn't happen because governments are betraying us anyway, or that it's all going to the World Bank? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, one of the things that really bothers me about the environmental movement when I look at the big NGOs, the big ANGOs, as they are called, is that they do not have an anti-capitalist analysis. You know, I'm not saying that things couldn't have gone this way if the world was ruled by socialism or communism. But in the end, capitalism is the name of the game right now, and capitalism requires exponential growth in order to survive. And we live in a finite world, and we can't do that. So the anti-capitalists have a very nuanced but yet very clear analysis that in order for the destruction of the planet to end, we need to end capitalism. We really need full system change. And that was an analysis that was even like outside the anti-capitalist bloc. So as we have seen through the years, when it comes to these talks and, you know, groups like the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank and the G20, when these folks meet, they're usually don't have the people's future or the people's well-being at stake. So as anti-capitalists, and I include myself in that group, we really think that what we do at these mobilizations is show people the farce that's happening behind the fence and basically hope that our discourse makes them change their tactics so that they actually use tactics that are going to lead them to victory, that are going to lead us to actually protect our world. To a certain degree, like, I'm amazingly disappointed in Cancun on many different levels. On another, I'm glad that things failed behind the fence as it was expected, even though the folks behind the fence claim victory, and that people start to see the reality that we don't have unlimited time to do this. So we really need to think of what are the things that are going to stop the destruction of the planet. And I think that's the most important thing that the anti-capitalist bloc brings to the table.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
The movement in Mexico concerning the COP16 was extremely divided. The two main camps, as I mentioned, Via Campesina and Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space, had some serious infighting, which prevented them from doing mobilizations together. I also saw the big NGOs, the big NGOs, doing big actions to garner media attention, and they didn't seem that plugged in with the grassroots groups. And so, you know, once again, you have egos, you have something they call in Latin American protagonism. Everybody's just trying to be the most badass activist group out there instead of jointly going forward and making a larger splash as a massive group of people. In that sense, you know, not only did the talks fail behind closed doors, but I'm really sad to say that the movement is headed by the so-called movement is headed by folks who are more interested in showing that they can do these actions and later garner more donations or more foundation money or whatever, where in the end the problem requires a much more visionary and a much more long-term view. And I just didn't see that in Cancun, unfortunately.
We're going to see that in some of your film, End Civ. I want to wrap up with that. First of all, what does End Civ stand for? And tell us a little bit about the film and how people can find it.
Yeah, the film End Civ means End of Civilization. And as I mentioned, is inspired by the works of Derek Jensen, in which his main premise or his main proposal is that civilization has to end for us to survive. And within that premise, he basically says that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. It's not a really hard idea to grasp, but I try to do my best to give Derek's work, which is an amazingly rich work, some justice. And people can see clips of the film, or they can buy the DVD at endciv.com. That's endciv.com.
Great. We've been talking with Franklin Lopez, and he's a producer and a multimedia kind of giant in a way, a one-man guy who also works with a team of other people, but is taking the idea of Be the Media to heart, and I think giving us a leadership role in that. So thanks a lot for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
And thanks for having me. I've been a fan for years.
Okay. This is Radio EcoShock, churning over the results of the 2010 COP16 climate talks in Cancun, Mexico. Our guest is British broadcaster and host of climate radio, Phil England. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, I want to start by thanking you for the fantastic radio shows on last year's Copenhagen talks from you and your team at Resonance FM in London. It was simply the best coverage of the conference, inside and outside. What a zoo to try and convey all that.
That's very, very kind of you to say so. It's also very exhausting. And, it's also quite a complex thing to get your head around, even if you're actually inside the negotiated conference center.
Well, these UN conferences are so complex. There's thousands of delegates, many speaking bureaucratic baffle-gab, it seems to me, and thousands more NGOs from all over the world speaking many languages. Help me hash through the results of this conference. So where would we start?
Well, there are lots of people that got good things to say about it. I mean, I think the main upside is that it has saved the multilateral process. The idea that all countries, all 193 countries in the world that are part of the UN can come together and try and work this out collectively so that everybody, in theory, has an equal say. That process, the UN process, has been saved, a lot of people are saying, because it has been on a very rocky road over the last few years. So I think that's a good outcome. It could have gone to kind of bilateral processes and more unrepresentative bodies like the G20, for example.
Firm limits to greenhouse gases were not set, but at least there was this shared vision, a goal of 2 degrees of warming maximum. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, the big downside, if you like, is that no rich country has agreed to raise their targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. So, overall, we're still on a pathway towards catastrophic levels of climate change. That's the bottom line message. But in the text, developed country parties are urged to increase their ambition in line with the recommendations in the IPCC's latest report. But that would only give us a 50-50 chance of keeping within 2 degrees C. And of course, we also know from the last IPCC report that serious impacts are going to happen at lower temperatures than previously thought. And a majority of countries support a 1.5 degrees C target or lower. So it's a bit odd that they're still insisting on going with this unsafe target of 2 degrees C and not having any means of achieving it at all. Bolivia, of course, made a very principled stand in the last couple of hours of the negotiation, saying that it would not agree to a text that leads to a 4 degrees C world, and saying that this would implicate it in genocide and ecocide. So that's pretty much the overall shared vision aspects of the text.
Phil, is the proposed $100 billion Green Fund real or more empty promises? What is your take?
Analysis have been done of the what's called the fast track funding, which was the money that rich countries promised to poor countries for signing on to the Copenhagen Accord from last year. And basically, hardly any of that is new money. And what's starting to appear is that rich countries want to offer this money not as grants, but as in the form of loans. So the countries that have done nothing to cause the problem of climate change are being asked to pay for cleaning up the mess with interest on top. That's a very poor development. Also, this $100 billion that is being talked about for 2020, they're hoping to scale it up to $100 billion by 2020. It's very unclear as to where that money is going to come from. And there's a lot of talk about it coming from the carbon markets. And the problem with that is that it's a way for rich countries to buy their way out of emissions cuts at home. And it shifts the burden, again, onto the poor countries, which is the wrong thing that should be happening. When you look at the deal that everybody signed, the framework that everybody's operating under in these talks is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 1992, which everybody, including the US, signed up to. And has a lot of stuff about fairness in it and who's responsible and who should be paying who. And this is now all seems to be taking a rather strange turn, you know, that the rich countries are trying to do their best to wriggle out of their responsibilities.
It sounds like climate imperialism, really, the way you describe it.
Well, in a sense, and there's a very worrying trend, well, worrying question mark over the role of the World Bank in all of this. I mean, basically, the G77 plus China, the 130-odd countries that are the poor majority at the UN, are basically have had on the table for some years now an opposition to any involvement for the World Bank. I mean, they basically see it as it's the institution that has that turned poor countries into debt slaves. And it's continuing to fund fossil fuel projects, you know, right as of today. It's the organization that makes dirty development possible and has done nothing to reform itself. So the G77 plus China, have their proposal that's been on the table for years now is that all climate finance should be under the democratic control of the UN and that there should be no role for the World Bank. It's unclear as to how that is going to play out over the next year. Currently, there is a token role for the World Bank, and the World Bank is making a big play to put itself at the center of all this in terms of its PR. But really, NGOs have got a lot of, and civil society have got a lot of work to do over the next year to try and to make that one come good.
How do you see the RED plan for protecting forests working out?
During the negotiations themselves, there were major concerns about the safeguards included in the forestry section of the agreement. Basically, there was no clear definition even of what constituted a forest, which essentially meant that you could have a perverse incentive in all this, where logging companies and countries could be essentially paid to cut down long-standing old-growth forests and replace it with short-growth timber for future logging. And for the climate, that's not a good solution at all. And it's been shown that one of the best ways for preserving the forest is actually to enhance the land rights of the indigenous people that actually live there. If we did that, there is evidence. There was a study in The New Scientist which said that that's the best way of protecting forests. It was a survey done over a number of years covering about 220 forests, a global study, and that was its conclusion. At the end of the conference, it's not a good sign that indigenous people are up in arms about what's currently on the table. So again, a lot of work to be done over the coming year.
We are talking over the Cancun Climate Conference results with Phil England, host of Climate Radio. Find his blog at climateradio.org. And you mentioned to me also in an email, Phil, that there is still a loophole for the rich countries. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's another thing which has been a firm decision on it. It has been put off until next year. But there's a rich country loophole called LULUCF, which is about land use change and forestry, and the way that rich countries account for that in their national emissions inventories. Essentially, it's been exposed as a big loophole. The good thing is that none of the bad options that are on the table haven't been agreed to. So again, there is still an opportunity for campaigners to get that one sorted satisfactorily over the coming year.
As we prepare for those next round of talks in Durban, South Africa in December 2011, do you have any more tips for listeners and activists, things they should be watching for or doing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to show is that there are ways of raising finance to fund this climate deal so that we get adequate funding to pay poor countries' adaptation and climate changing impacts, and also to help them develop in a clean way. We need to show that we can get adequate funds for that that don't come from the carbon markets, that are realistic. And the best option that's on the table is the so-called Robin Hood tax. I don't know if you've come across that in Canada. It's a big campaign here in the UK. It's a kind of rebranded take on the Tobin tax,
right,
which is this small tax on financial transactions. And it can raise, you know, hundreds of billions, just a very small tax. And that should really be given serious consideration. And I think a campaign, ramped up campaign for that, would be something seriously to get our teeth into next year.
I'm Alex Smith from the UK. You've been listening to longtime radio host Phil England helping with the Cancun Climate Conference wrap-up. Get more from my show blog at ecoshock.info and certainly from Phil's site. Check it out at climateradio.org. Phil England, you are one of the people I learned from, I have to tell you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks, Alex. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.